Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juwanza. Man, it is a beautiful day today. I hope it's as beautiful wherever you are as it is where I am, because for February, it has just been lovely, and I'll take it, I will take it, I will take it. I've got a fabulous show lined up for you, everybody. For all of you who've been following the show, you know that once a month I have a special guest on, and he is our resident entrepreneur guru, okay? He has written two fabulous books. Some of you know who I'm talking about because you've been following. But for those who are just tuning in and you're not familiar with my special guest, his name is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Now, if you are an entrepreneur, or if you know of someone who is an entrepreneur, if you are an entrepreneur and you're listening, you're in the right place. If you know somebody who's an entrepreneur or is thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, you need to get on the phone and call them right now and tell them to tune in, because they're going to get information today that can save them a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money, okay? And I'm going to introduce you to him in a second, but I just want to let you know he is the author of a fabulous book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, and it's 105 Business Principles, I believe. I say I believe because the book keeps growing. You know, you could have added another principle by now. So 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, Entrepreneurial Success. And he's also author of Finding a Career for Life, The Road to the Top. Now, this is an awesome book as well, and we'll tell you all about that and how you can get that book as well. Finding a Career for Life and Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. That's the book that we're going to be talking about tonight. So let me introduce you to my special guest. Professor Joseph Geiger he's retired now, but he grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. Over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College, located in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently resides. So, again, if you are an entrepreneur and you've, you know, been in business for a while, you can always learn something, okay? And there are at least 105 principles that you need to know about, and they're in this book, and we'll tell you how you can get the book during the course of the show. But let me get to my guest, Professor Joseph Geiger. Great to have you back. Always a pleasure. Can't wait to get into another fabulous interview with you.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it, Juwanza.
Well, as promised, everybody, we're getting into a book that you need to have. If you are an entrepreneur and you are serious about business, you need this book. And again, it's 105 business principles, not just for business, but for life. And so, you know, I'm always, you know, wondering how people got into business, what started them on their path. And for the people that are new, just tuning in, and you've never heard Professor Geiger before, I'll ask you, Professor, if you don't mind, sharing what got you started in business. I mean, you've been doing it for over 50 years. You've started over 10 businesses, and you know, it's been a long journey for you. How did it begin?
Yeah, actually, I've been doing it for over 65 years, and I started when I was in high school with the first one. I'm dyslexic, so my parents had sent me to a boarding school in Massachusetts, and I lived in Kansas. And the only reason they could afford to get me in there is because the school wanted people from all over the country, and the vast majority of their students were from New England. And so my dad got a very, very special deal at just a fraction of the cost, what it usually would be. And but it also meant that when I was there, they had a little canteen where the students could go buy chocolate bars and you know, whatever they wanted, little stuff. But I didn't have an allowance. Most of the students had a $10 or $20 a week allowance, and there was just no way that my father was going to do that. So I was looking for a way to make enough money to be able to do that, and I noticed that at the school, the students, most of whom, as I said, were from New England, all wanted to read the Sunday New York Times, and it wasn't available. So I called, found the people who distributed it where the school was, and tried to talk them into giving me some copies on the cuff, which they would not do. So I talked 20 of the students into paying for a semester worth of Sunday New York Times in advance. And with that, I was able to buy the papers, and I started with 20. And 3 years later, when I left the school, I had well over 100. I had most of the students who were there were getting the New York Times. And so that's what instigated me to start it. The one I had before when I was in college, I needed a way to pay for the college, and I ran into a way of finding a little business opportunity, and we'll talk about that later in this, not this program, but in one of the programs to come, on how to find business opportunities, and I'll tell you how that one developed at that time. So that's kind of how I started. And let me do a little self-promotion on the book. The first eight principles are kind of general, and we're going to be doing, starting with number five and going probably through number eight. They're sort of general ones, but after that, the principles tend to be very specific. And the reason I wrote the book is because the textbooks that I was using, I kept asking myself, now, if I was an entrepreneur, and I'd been one many, many times, and somebody told me something out of one of these books, could I do it? And the answer was no, I could not. So I thought that people who had, who were interested, who were in my class, needed a way of finding things that you could actually execute. And so that was the history of how that started.
Well, let me ask you this, Professor, because you've been in business for so long. You started as an entrepreneur, starting businesses while you were still in college. After college, did you ever hold a 9-to-5? You know, did you ever work for anybody else at all?
I did before I started my little business. I did. I was a busboy at restaurants, and I started out at family restaurants and pretty quickly learned that the tips, which is what I was going to have to live off of, what they paid at that time was 75 cents an hour. But you could make more on the tips. And I found that I discovered that the more expensive the restaurant, the higher the tips. So mm-hmm. If you went to a family restaurant where, well, I'll put it in today's bills, let's say that you fed your family of four for $20, don't expect much of a tip. But if you go to a restaurant where you fed your family of four and it was $120, you'll probably get a pretty good tip. So that was the only time until I retired and I no longer had a business. And then I, at that time, goodness, I was in my 60s when I first had a, other than as a busboy, in a restaurant, a full-time, you know, a regular job.
Was that at the college?
No. Well, actually, it started at the college. Yes, it was. And I started at the college. I was looking for something kind of part-time, and so I was a rent-a-cop at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College, where I was part of the police or security service, although the regular, the full-timers who had been through, who were really the same, they had the same training as the city police. They carried firearms, but I did not. You know, I was just a security person who walked around there in a uniform and hoped that people would do what I asked them to do.
Well,
so I was there, and I had a job at Home Depot and a couple of other little part-timers, you know. So that's
I'm sure that the feeling of working those little jobs could not compare to the feeling of owning your own business, starting your own business, growing your own business, and actually watching the idea come to fruition and, you know, going to work on weekends, you know
yeah.
what I'm saying? So
yep.
for everybody
well, there, there's
a, the
there certainly is a big difference. I kind of enjoyed those, but the on the plus side, there was virtually zero feeling that you stress to them. But in small business, there is a fairly high amount of stress where you run your own business, because there, if it loses money, it loses your money. And when you're working for somebody, if the business loses money, it doesn't lose your money, it loses their money. And so you're not there just isn't anything even close to the stress level. On the other side, there isn't anything even close to the feeling of that, hey, I did this. I started out from nothing, and look at it now. We have 25 people working, and, hey, this is pretty neat. So there's two sides to the coin, and starting a business is definitely not for everybody. It would not work at all well for my wife. She is just not that sort. And that's not good or bad. It just is what is. And I think for the vast majority of people, it's that way. Although the Bureau of Labor Statistics is now saying that way over 30%, the last figure I saw, which is about 5 years old now, 33% of all people who earn money from any source, you know, whether they be a janitor, an hour laborman, or they're an executive for AT&T, way over 30%, probably approaching 40% now, will at some time in their life attempt to be an entrepreneur. Doesn't mean they're going to succeed, but they're going to have a go at it. The Bureau of Labor Statistics calls it a oh, goodness, I just lost what I was going to say on the word. Proprietor is what they call it.
Right.
But essentially, it's an entrepreneur, which means that if you are in high school, when you graduate from high school and you look around through your class here, approaching 35 to 40% of all the students who graduate will attempt to be an entrepreneur sometime in their life. And if you go to college, that's probably a whole lot closer to 50%. An awful lot of them will fail, unfortunately, but it's a very, very high percentage in this country who attempt to be entrepreneurs.
And I want everybody that's listening, don't think Professor is being pessimistic when he says that many of them will fail. That's stats, okay?
Yeah, that's
those
just
are
the facts. That's just the fact.
So if we want everybody to know that you can reduce the risk of failure by doing it the right way, and if you listen to people who have done it, okay, not just somebody that's written a book with 10 principles, but maybe somebody who's done it, actually started their own business, ran it, knows it, and can tell you how it's done, then that's the purpose of this show, and that's the purpose of this book. And we're now in chapter one, and we're on the fifth principle, which is know what you are not good at. Professor, could you talk about knowing what you're not good at? There are sometimes when people start businesses and they want to do everything, but sometimes you got to know what you're not good at.
Well, I think you always have to know what you're not good at. It's important to know what you're good at, but if you're good at it, it's probably going to turn out pretty well. If you're not good at it, it probably is not going to turn out very well. And that's one of the problems that people have when you first start. You may think that, well, all of a sudden you realize, hey, it's my money that's being spent. And when that comes home to you, which will happen very quickly, I mean, like on the first or second day, then you get pretty covetous of who's going to decide to spend money. Because you start to think, well, heck, it's my money. I'm going to decide to spend it all. And nobody else is. Well, that works when you're really, really small. But once you start going and you hire a few people, it frankly doesn't work very well, because all of us have our gifts and those things that we're not very good at. And I think it's way more important to figure out what you're not good at than it is to find out what you are good at. What you are good at, again, is going to work out pretty well. But there are things probably that you're not very good at, and you best find out what those are, and then find somebody who is good at them and turn that task over to the person who's good at it, and then get the heck out of their way. And that last part, get out of their way, is very, very important. It's a something it took me a long time to learn. I had a hard time with it because, again, it was my money that was being spent. And although maybe I realized that I wasn't very good at this, this other person was spending my money, and I thought I could do it better. Well, frankly, I couldn't. And I've had, on a number of occasions, have had people say, look, either I'm going to do this or you're going to do it. If you want to do it, then you do it, and I will either go find another job or just do what you tell me. But if you want me to do it, well, then let me do it and get the heck out of my way. And normally when I figured that one out and said, yes, sir, I think you're right, and I got the heck out of their way, things worked out a lot better.
You know, well, I'm sure that individual had to exhibit trustworthiness and prove to you that they could do it before you got the heck out of the way, because I'm sure that part of you being in the way was because you felt at the very least that you could do it. And I don't know if it was a lack of trust in their competence that they would do it right or that they wouldn't do it right, you know, that caused you to, you know, I guess, be in the way, so to speak. But I think that's partly why a lot of people are in the way, because it is their money that's being spent, and if it's not done right, then it's not going to fall on the person. I mean, at the very least, the person that does it wrong, the worst that can happen to them is they get fired. But the owner is going to carry the brunt of, you know, the mistake. He's going to be the one with the big headache.
Well, that's true, John. But what's also true is that once you have a few people that are working for you, you're going to know less and less about the details of each task that's being done. The person who is actually doing the task, if they are sharp and if you did a good job of hiring, is going to know more about that task than you do, just because that person is dealing with it every hour of every day. You're not. And what happens is you go in there, they give you a 5-minute synopsis, and you think you're going to make a good decision on it, and maybe you will, but the odds are frankly against you, because they've been working on it for hours or days, and they give you a 5 or a 10-minute synopsis. There is no possible way that you're going to know all the nuances of what's going on. It's just not possible. Sun Tzu said that the person who is closest to the job should make the decision, not the person way up the line. And that's one of the – it was true 2,500 years ago when Sun Tzu wrote it. It's true today. And so you just need to understand that if the person is good enough for you to hire them and good enough for you to put them in the job, and they've proven that they can do it, well, then let them do it. And if they can't do it, then find somebody who can. The odds are probably better that if they're good at it than if you tried to do it, because you, by your own admission, are not all that good at it. That's why you hired somebody to do it. So it's just a feeling that you have to have, and it's hard to do. I mean, it sounds like when you're hearing me say this, it's awful easy to say, hey, dunderhead, anybody with an IQ above 5 should know that. But when you're out there doing it, and again, it's your money, you find you're making decisions that evidently you don't have an IQ above 5 because you wouldn't do that. So let them do it. Find somebody who can do the job, who know it better than you do. And I'm thinking now of dozens of people, well, a couple in particular, who could do things way better than I could. And I meddled, and they finally came to me and said, look, either I do it or you do it, but we both can't do it.
Everybody must have guessed it's Professor Geiger. We're going through his book, Principle by Principle. The name of the book is Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. That was Know What You're Not Good At. The next one I really love is Someone Must Be in Charge. You know, oftentimes when you take businesses, people, friends might come together and decide, you know, we got this great idea, we're going to start this business and make a lot of money. Family as well, that's another big one, family. They, you know, come together and say, okay, look, you know, we've got this idea, I'm going to do this, you're going to do that, and they're passing out, you know, duties. But somebody's got to be in charge. Can you talk about it, Professor?
Yep, that again, that comes again partially from Sun Tzu, who was a Chinese general who wrote a book, The Art of War. It's the oldest book in constant print, and it was originally written some 2,500 years ago. And this was one of his principles, that you have to have one person in charge. In modern days, it's very common for people to try to put together groups and give the group an idea or a problem to solve and think that the group can solve it. Well, the joke in business is if you had a group try to design a racehorse, what they would come up with is a camel, because somebody would want one thing and another person would want another thing. And so nobody, you try to get everybody happy, and what you have is mediocrity. So somebody has to be in charge, and if you have a group that you put together that is to solve a problem or do a job, you best make somebody in charge. Now, that doesn't mean that that person in charge is going to be a blooming dictator. The person in charge, part of their task is to see to it that all the bases are covered. When I teach a course, one of the big projects, almost half of the course grade, is a group project to do a business plan. And again, we'll later on in this program, we will talk about that. And what I pick out five people. I tell them, let's say I have 20 students, and I said I want four groups of five or five groups of four. I don't care. You guys decide, break it. And then when they've decided who's going to be in each of their groups and they're happy with that, I don't try to tell them. I mean, I let them do that. That's all part of the course, to understand that you have to have people to work together. And then I tell them, now, I want you guys to pick somebody in your group to be in charge, to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed and things work out. And if you don't want to do that, that's fine. But I'll tell you up in front that if you don't do it, you're going to run into troubles, because that's just the way it is. And that's because of principle number six, somebody must be in charge. And if you don't do that, you're going to have a problem. And it doesn't make any difference if you're planning a vacation or a picnic or you're putting together a program that is going to hire 1,000 people. Somebody must be in charge. And if you don't have somebody who makes the final decision, it doesn't work. In the Second World War, in the European theater, General Eisenhower was in charge. And if you watch any movies or read anything about it, he let other people come up with the basic ideas, and they would present him with a number of possibilities. But he and only he made the final decision. And that's the way it's got to be. And it, again, it doesn't make any difference whether you have 200,000 people storming a beach in Normandy, or you've got two people putting together a printing, you know, you're in the printing business and they're putting together a print program. Somebody must be in charge.
Well, what about, Professor, where you have people that start businesses and they're listed as co-founders, and in order to make sure that things are kind of balanced out, they might have a situation where before any major action is taking place, they need both signatures, you know, on the document or whatever, before anything goes, you know, anything major happens. What about situations like that? We have co-founders who might be equally qualified. They both have might both have MBAs, you know, and they started the business together. I mean, and I'm keeping in mind what you're saying, but I'm just saying, what would you say to somebody who is raising that question as far as co-founders and then trying to balance the power by suggesting that, okay, or implementing a plan where you need two signatures at least before any major action is taken on a particular issue?
Well, what the smart thing to do is there are very, very disparate tasks. Let's say that you have a manufacturing company. So if you have a manufacturing company, you're going to have to raise money. You're going to have to pay people. You're going to have to hire people. You're going to have to decide what you're going to build. You're going to have know how to market it, and so on. And so if they're smart, the two of them may say, okay, for any really major thing, we're going to have both of us have got to sign off on this. But if it has to do with marketing, then partner number one is in charge. And partner number two is going to sign off, and unless he has some awful, awful, awful strong feelings, he's going to go with whatever one says. And then when it comes to accounting, maybe number two is in charge and raising money and doing stuff like that. Then number one is going to be the one who goes along. But if you have a deal where both of them have to sign off on everything and nobody between the two of them has decided who's in charge, eventually it's going to be a problem. And that's just the way it is. And I have never heard of any big business or small or looking at one of the problems that government things don't work out very well is because they all are run by a bloody committee and nobody really is in charge. So nothing really gets done very well.
Okay. Principle number seven, another great one, because a lot of times in business today, you can go anywhere and see just the opposite of excellence. A lot of times people have kind of gotten away from customer service. But let's talk about that. Maintaining excellence is a state of mind. Maintaining excellence is a state of mind. Professor?
Well, what happens in businesses, small or large, they tend to take on the character of the person who is in charge, who is the boss of it, whether it's an army in the military or it's a small company of two or three people, whatever it is, they tend to take on how the owner works. And if the owner is pretty lackadaisical and goes along to gets along and shows up at work at 9:30 in the morning and takes a 3-hour lunch and leaves at 4, don't expect your employees to be very hardworking and very punctual. I mean, basically what you're saying as the owner is it doesn't really matter. You don't really need to show up. Look at me. I don't really show up. I don't really do anything. I leave early. I take long lunch breaks, and I'm having a great time. And so people tend to follow that. And the ones that the companies and the organizations who have very strong personalities don't have that. A great example is virtually everybody has heard about General Patton in the Second World War, and his Third Army was extraordinarily dynamic. When he got into to France, I mean, he just dashed ahead of everybody. Well, it wasn't him. It was the whole Third Army. But the other armies could have done it too. But they didn't have a George Patton running the show. And he was. There are some other great examples. General Electric, for years and years and years, had all kinds of very different businesses, and they all were very successful. And the reason is, I think, is because they always had for many years extremely dynamic people as the president or the chairman of the board, the very top person. And everybody understood that, boy, they're going to come up to his standards or hers in a couple of cases. They better be pretty darn good. And I can think of a couple of hers. The person running Beach Aircraft for 25 years was Ollie Van Beach. It wasn't the owner, Mr. Beach. He was there as an engineer, but Ollie Van ran that company, and anybody who thought they didn't, when they got in there, they got disabused of that stupid idea pretty quickly, because she, by God, ran it. And she, you know, she was a lovely lady. I've met her quite a number of times many years back. She's been dead for quite a few years now. She ran the show, and everybody there understood that she ran the show. So when they wanted something done, or when she wanted something done, by God, it got done. And that she was very, very good at it, and she had this dynamic state of mind that everybody had to aspire to. And those who didn't stay very long.
You know, that's so interesting, because the leader has to be able to, I guess, infuse, for lack of a better term, that personality into the workers, because somebody, for example, just to use a Coke Pepsi analogy, you know, somebody who's coming in to apply for a job, you know, they're coming to apply for a job. You know, it's like, you know, if they work at Coke, you know, they go to Coke because Coke hired them, but they will work for Pepsi in a minute if Pepsi pays them more money.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, just to be able to infuse that excellence in people to get that allegiance that, hey, our customers are important. You know, you come to work, you do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and to, you know, aspire to excellence, because, again, people that are coming in applying for work, they need a job. I mean, they'll work there, but they'll also work somewhere else.
Sure. Well, I think that's one of the things about being an entrepreneur. If the reason you want to be an entrepreneur is because you see people who own businesses who have big homes and fancy cars and go on vacations and all of that sort of stuff, and you say, boy, that's what I want, the chances are you've got a couple of strikes against you before you start, because in most cases, they didn't start out that way. If they started the business, they surely didn't start that way. They started where, you know, it was many, many hours every day, and the last person who gets paid is the owner. And if you have enough money every month, and after you paid all your bills that you should, and you paid all your people, if there's anything left over, you get paid. And if there isn't, you don't get paid. So you learn pretty quickly that it's very long hours and very hard work, and that you're what everybody is looking at. And if you're just kind of drooping around there, you're going to find out that your people droop around too. And if you're there every morning when they show up and you're there every night when they leave, and, you know, you're interested in what they're doing, and you, for those who do a good job, you say so. And for those who don't, you also say so. That is extremely important in making any business really hum.
Well, everybody, we're moving down the book principle by principle. We're on principle number 8 now, and this is very important because sometimes people don't have a backup plan. But this principle is, if this plan doesn't work, what's plan B? Professor?
Yeah, you need to have a backup plan. All of these first 8 principles work in business, but they also have very strong application in your own life, and that is pretty darn important. If you're a college student and you're going to college and you decide that I'm not so sure I want to get a liberal arts education, then where's that taking you? What is the purpose of going to college? And if you don't have an answer to that, you better get an answer to that, because it's extremely important. And if whatever you're working towards doesn't work out, what then? And so you need to have a plan B. Let's say that you decide that you're going to try to learn to be a construction superintendent. So you go to college, and that's what you're going to be. And when you come out, guess what? You actually graduated in 2008, and the whole construction business had just collapsed. And there are people, superintendents, who have got 25 years of experience, and they just don't have a job because their company went under, and you're looking for a first-timer. What then? And chances are, what then is pretty bleak for you. So maybe you ought to learn to be a carpenter. Maybe you ought to learn to be something else as a backup. So you have something to fall back on. And people who don't do that, some of them it works out fine. I mean, you know, so you graduate in 2017, and guess what? 2017, the back end of that, business is humming, they're hiring people, and so away you go. And you, you know, it works out for you, but it might not work out for you. The same thing is true in business. You have a plan on what you're going to do, and what happens when you get to the end of it, and your Gantt chart or your cash flow forecast all of a sudden looks, oops, we're not making it here. Well, what then? And it's one of the reasons that you learn to do plans, is because when you do that and you do your planning, you don't wait until you're on the thresholds of failure and your bank account is down close to zero before you figure out that, hey, this isn't going to work. You need to find that out well ahead of time and have a plan B.
Well, what about people, Professor, who would say, well, you know, what about tunnel vision? You know, you got to stay focused on the goal. You can't take your eye off the prize. You know, you got to stay, you know, you got to stay focused. Don't consider doing anything else. You know, if you want to succeed, you know, you got to throw all caution to the wind, and you got to, you know, just keep your eye on the prize. Don't move to the right. Don't move to the left, you know. And for some, a plan, a second plan to them is almost insinuating that there's a possibility that the first plan might not work, which, of course, that is always present. That possibility is always
there.
but I think that a lot of times.
What I've noticed in my long life is that there tends to be a whole lot of different ways of doing the same thing. I guess a fairly good example is how we put clothes together. When man first learned how to do clothing, which was, as I understand it, about 170,000 years ago, they draped animal skins over them, and then they kept falling off. So they tied them on. And then, sure enough, they came up with belts. Well, belts work pretty well, but somebody invented buttons. And, well, actually, buttons work pretty well. So what do you need to have a zipper for? Well, zipper works well, too. And now we have belts and zippers and ropes and ties. And so you certainly don't need Velcro. Well, actually, Velcro works pretty well, too. So there's a lot of ways of doing the same thing. And this is a pretty simple example of that. But in business, you will find, and frankly, I think also in life, there's a whole lot of different ways of doing a task. And just because you think you have the slam best one ever, the odds are very high that there is another way of doing it, and that might be better still. So it is important to keep your eye on the prize, but the eye on the prize is the result, not the method of getting to the result. The prize is the result. And one should always remember that there's more than one way of getting to the result.
And there may be more than one prize.
That's right.
You know, and there
absolutely
may actually be more than
one. Absolutely. There may very well may be more than one prize. There's all kinds of examples of people who have started businesses to do one thing, and they found out there was something else they could do, and it worked out to be a whole lot better than the thing they first thought they should do. Mm-hmm. So the prize is the result. And to say that, well, I've got to keep my eye on the prize, that's true, but the prize is, again, the prize is the result.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Geiger. We're going through his book, Principle by Principle. We're up to actually Chapter 3 now. That last one was the last principle in Chapter 2. Maybe
no,
we can get one
last,
in.
It's the last one in Chapter 1.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, correct.
Yeah,
the last one
go.
In Chapter 1. Thank you. So let's look at Chapter 2. Maybe we can get one in, at least one good one, maybe two. Finding Business Opportunities is the title of Chapter 2. Finding Business Opportunities. I know you have said, Professor, that business opportunities are everywhere you look. You just got to know what you're looking for and how to find them. And so let's take principle number 9, which states, ask the question, is there a business opportunity here?
Yeah, that's. I mentioned that when we first started, and you asked me how I got started in business, my second business was very much that. And I grew up on a farm in Kansas. There was a stream that went through the farm, and when I was a little boy, probably about 6, 7, 8 years old, I was down there fishing in it whenever I could, and my grandparents. One time I had pounced on a grasshopper as bait, and the grasshopper was sitting in some little cactuses, and I got cactus thorns all over me. And my grandmother, for Christmas, gave me a little set that I could make really artificial lures. It was designed for trout flies, but I wasn't fishing for trout in Kansas. But so I could make a fake grasshopper, and I didn't have to pounce on it, and I got pretty good at doing it. And when I went away to college, first at Colorado College and then to University of Denver, I was you'd ask me what I was doing, had I ever worked for somebody, and yes, I had. I was a busboy and then a waiter. But it was long hours, and I didn't make very much. And I had gone fishing one weekend in Colorado, and I had also learned how to make very, very tiny trout flies. And they were smaller than you could easily set one on the end of your little finger. I mean, they were little tiny things. And I learned to do it just because it was a challenge to do. So, but they also caught lots of fish under certain circumstances. And one afternoon in August, I guess it was, I was fishing on the South Platte River, and I was catching lots of big brown trout on these little tiny flies. And I noticed a guy watching me. So I waded ashore. He asked me, as soon as I got ashore and where he could talk to me, he said, "What are you catching all those fish on?" I saw him out there. I saw him coming up to the surface, but I never could get one to bite. And I showed him the little tiny trout flies I had, and he said, "Where'd you buy them?" I said, "Well, actually, I made them." And he said, "Well, could I buy some from you?" And I said, "Well, I'll give you one." And he said, "No, I'd rather buy them, and I'll buy three of them for $10. Well, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but that's the same as since then. I think there's been about a 5 times inflation rate. So that's kind of like saying, could I buy three for $50 today? And the answer to that, as a starving college student, was not yes, but hell yes, of course. So he did, and on the way driving home, I thought to myself, I wonder if there's anybody else who would be interested. So when I got home, I thought, I'll do that, but I'd better have some way of showing them. So I bought some little tiny pill boxes, and I put three of these little trout flies, three different kinds, in a pill box, and took them to the fanciest fishing store in Denver, and tried to sell them to them. And the onset was that they decided, yeah, they'd buy them. And I got $3 or $6 per box. And I could make about 3 boxes an hour. So I ended up where, if I was doing it today, that was about $125 an hour that I could make, which certainly was way more than you can make as a busboy or a waiter. And that's how I got started. Well, how was it? Somebody wanted to buy them, and I asked myself, is there a business opportunity here? And sure enough, there was. And it allowed me to pay for my last 2 years of college without having to work very hard and live pretty good. Because even today, $125 an hour is fairly good wages.
You know, Professor, I was going to ask you another question that wasn't a principle, so I'll just go ahead and ask it, because
okay.
Even as when you were sharing how you were going to give it to the guy, the trout fly, to the guy for free, he said, no, I'll pay you for it, and he ended up paying you for it. There are actually people that have difficulty, for example, pricing certain things because of their morals, quote, end quote, you know, or ethics, quote, end quote. Maybe
mm-hmm.
ethics isn't a good word. But, you know, they have a problem selling for more than what they paid for it. You know, they think they're ripping the other person off or something, you know. So did pricing ever come into play with you? Was that ever an issue for
you?
Oh,
yeah.
For example,
I mean, I have priced everything from a box of trout flies to a $500,000 yacht. And in most cases, you can look around and see what similar products are selling for, whether it be a lipstick for ladies or a spoon or a pocket knife or a car or a jet airplane, whatever it is. And there's somebody out there who's already making a similar item, and they're selling it for an amount. And if they're selling them and people are willing to pay for it, then that helps you price. And basically, nobody likes to say this, but it's true. It's what the traffic will bear. And if you sell it for, I certainly could have sold those trout flies instead of where they retail for $10 a box. I could have sold them for $5 a box. And instead of getting $6 per box for three of them, I would have gotten three. And they would have sold, I couldn't have sold any more because everything I could possibly make, that sporting goods store would take. And it didn't make any difference whether I came down there with five boxes or with 25 boxes. The answer is yes, here's your check. Because they knew that they would get snapped up all the time and that people would take them. And it took me a long, long time to figure out why anybody would pay $2 for a little tiny trout fly when they could buy a similar one, only a good deal bigger, for 20 cents, which they could have.
Right.
So why would they spend $2 for it and instead of 20 cents? The guy actually told me why when I first met him, the one I met on the stream, the fisherman who bought the first 10 of them, $10 worth, three. And I offered him my fishing rod and said, well, you want to go catch a fish? Because all you got to do is go out there and throw it out and bam, you'll catch one. You saw how easy it was. And he said, no, I want to show these to my friends. He said, I've never seen anything like this, and I want to show them to my friends. And with that, he walked off. And I thought when I was making and selling those trout flies that the reason people bought them was the same reason I wanted them, because they caught fish when others wouldn't. But that's not the reason at all. The reason is because they were a work of art. Nobody had ever seen anything that tiny that were so nice. And they were just like the regular trout flies that they had, only tiny, tiny miniatures. And I didn't realize that until many years later. But the person told me, if I had been willing to listen, which I wasn't, when he bought them, the first group that were bought by a gentleman who told me why, but I didn't listen. And people should listen very, very carefully. And the reason he bought them, he said, I want to show them to my friends. Not I want to go catch fish with them, because I offered him my rod with one on it that obviously had caught fish. He just had watched me do it.
Right.
So when you go to price, maybe you ought to dig the wax out of your ears and listen very carefully to people, what they say. And I've had a lot of people, my wife sometimes says, you don't listen to me. Well, if I'm doing something else, particularly listening to somebody else, I am really listening to what they say. I mean, with rapt concentration, and because of that experience. It took me years to figure that out. And the guy told me right on the trout stream why he was buying them. I want to show them to my friends. And why did he want to do that? Because they were a work of art. They were different.
And I think when you look around the world today, that's why, you know, you might have certain people that go to auctions and pay God knows how much money for a piece of art or something that other people look at and scrounge their face up like, what? He paid how much?
You gotta be kidding me. Yeah, that's true. That is absolutely true. What, just because you don't like it doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't like it. And I've got all kinds of examples of that, where people didn't like something and they were going to just turn it into junk or throw it away. I have a friend who had a big old printing press, a Heidelberg printing press, which was when he sold it, it was probably 80 years old. But a Heidelberg printing press is made to last forever. and he needed to have, he no longer used it, and he was going to turn it into just scrap iron. And he decided, well, he'd put it put it for sale on the internet. This is when the internet first started. He ended up selling it for $28,000 to a person in South America. And the person in South America flew up to California and picked it up. He had set it out in back of his shop, and he picked it up and took it away and gave him a check for it. And the guy was going to just turn it into scrap iron because he said, nobody wants this thing. Nobody uses it. Well, not really. There was a guy who did use it. And he said, when I put it on the internet, I got offers from all over the world. Big surprise. Mm-hmm. So just because you don't like something doesn't necessarily mean that others don't like it. Because they very
well
may.
That sounds like another principle. That sounds like a principal, Professor.
There you go.
Hey, Professor, we've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to tell everybody, first of all, let me tell you that next month, if not sooner, when Professor comes back, we will start with principle number 10. Be happy, do what you love, and what you are good at doing. Be happy, do what you love, and what you are good at doing. Okay, so that's, we're going to leave off on principle number 9. Next month when Professor comes back, we'll start with principle number 10. But I want to tell people about your other book, Professor, Finding a Career for Life, The Road to the Top. Would you tell our listeners about that book and what they can
expect
when
they get this? Well, it's just a little short book. It's only 75 pages, and it's a book of statistics and basic information about what jobs pay and what people like about them or dislike about them, whether a particular job is something they really like and does it pay well. And I think particularly for young people, they want something that at least they can make a living at and that they enjoy doing. And just because people think they will enjoy doing something doesn't necessarily mean they will. And in the book, there's hundreds of types of jobs that are talked about in there, and in many, many of them, it gives what people who are currently doing that job on that career path, what they are paid, and also whether they really like it. And there are big surprises, for me at least, there were. I mean, things that I thought people would really like, they don't, and others where I thought, well, it's just a way of making a living, they absolutely love. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with pay. So it's before when one of the things that's happening is people in America are being told, young people are told, that in order to get a good job, you have to have a college education. That is patently not true. There are all kinds of jobs that pay very well, that people like doing, that you don't have to have a college education. Being a fireman is one of them. Being a policeman is one. Being a professional pilot is one. You don't have to have a college education for any of those. But people who are doing those generally like them. They're paid very well. And then there's other jobs that people have that they think they're going to like, and they don't. This business is the higher the education, the more it's paid. Absolutely not true. In other than medicine, other than being an MD, the highest paid job out there, year after year after year, is being a petroleum engineer, and it takes a 4-year education. There is no 6-year or 8-year education, no master's or PhD or MBA that even comes close in price, in salary to a petroleum engineer. Now, there is in medicine. That's the one exception. But there you're talking about 8 or 10 or 12 years and specialties. So, but that's basically what that book says. And so it's pure fact. And so often young people are getting agenda thrown in to, if they, you want to be a, you know, you have to go to 4 years, and so you take this course, and I hear over and over again, all you have to do is have a four-year degree, and you got it made. That's not true. That is absolutely not true. So, and
you know,
I don't have any agenda at all. My only agenda is facts. What's the facts?
Hey, Professor, before you go, somebody wants to speak to you. Can you hold on 1 second?
Sure.
Before you go, somebody got a call coming in. Okay, 4644, you're on the air with Professor Geiger.
Hello,
you know,
there.
Hello, how you doing?
Fine.
My grandson is a gas and petroleum engineer.
Uh-huh.
Double majoring with business, a degree in business, and all with the energy minor.
Uh-huh.
And he's also carrying certification in AutoCAD.
Uh-huh.
And also 3D printing.
Wow, he's got
and,
backup everywhere.
And coding. Plus, he's got his OSHA general. And he's going to get his OSHA certification in the gas and oil field.
Okay.
Myself, I was a structural steel erector. I erected structural steel buildings like the ones that fell down.
Yeah.
In New York. I owned my own business, probably the only African American that was involved in mid and heavy structural steel.
Good for
in
you.
The St. Louis area in southern Illinois. But I understand what you're talking about the degree. I still think that people should, if they can, you get those degrees, and especially in those areas where there's a great demand.
You and your son-in-law are doing it right.
My grandfather. My grandson.
Your grandson. You're doing it with a purpose. What I'm talking about is those people who say if you get a degree, any degree, doesn't make any difference what it is, you're going to be in tall cotton. Well, you're not. If you did get a degree in anything you have or your grandson has, absolutely. But to get a degree in social work,
well, I agree with you.
To make anything. To get a degree in
childhood education,
art, our childhood, that's fine. And if you get it, I mention all that stuff, and I don't try to tell people not to do that. I just tell them that if you do, it's going to cost you the same to get a degree in childhood education as it is to get a degree in petroleum engineering. But as a petroleum engineer in your mid-career, you're probably going to make $180,000 a year. And in childhood education, you'll be lucky to make $28,000 a year. But
yeah, you're right about that.
The same.
Yeah.
And a hamburger costs the same. So which are you better off? Now, if you absolutely love it, well, then bless your heart, go for it. But please understand to start with that your income is limited, where in other things that you did or your grandson is doing are almost not limited. I mean, your grandson has got a backup after the backup.
Plus, he plays baseball for the college, so.
Well, forget the baseball. That he could do for fun, but the others he can do for a living. And
well, he's a hot little
sure
prospect.
That they will have a, you know, maybe he'll make it in baseball, but your chances are slim. However, his chances in the other things are absolutely excellent.
Well, when he was coming up, I put those demands, academics, and also if he
good
wanted to do
you.
Sports, but the academics had to come for it. But I would listen to the conversation. And we need to have more conversations on these topics. And one other thing too. I think that parents should direct their children into areas rather than letting them choose. You should start early. You need to evaluate that child along many disciplines to see where they would be more acclimated, and start early and start preparing them so that they can succeed when they are presented with the rigors that those majors require. But anyway, I continue to listen.
Okay, please
thank
do.
You so much.
And you can get the books at Amazon and the Finding a Career for Life, The Road to the Top is Amazon. It's only less than $10. and Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, also at Amazon. Be sure that you put the 105 Business Principles down there, because there's all kinds of others with the same title, Entrepreneurial Success. And that one's, I think, less than $19.
And they can get a cash flow forecast as well, correct, Professor?
There you go. You sure can. You sure can.
You're going to need it.
Yep.
You're definitely going to need
it. There you go.
Professor, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. You gave us a little extra today. Thank you, caller, for calling in. I see the callers are on the board lit up. Thank you so much, everybody. Spread the word. Professor Geiger is our resident entrepreneur guru. Okay, if you want to know anything about becoming an entrepreneur, starting a business, growing a business, finding a business, you know, financing a business, you got to get this book, okay? It's called Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles. Again, if you get it from Amazon, don't forget to put the 105 Business Principles, because there are other, like Professor Geiger said, there are other books with a similar name, okay? The Road to the Top, Professor Geiger, that's Geiger, G-E-I-G-E-R. Professor, any parting words for our listeners today? Thank you so much. Great show.
Great show. Looking forward to next week or next time you have me.
Okay, let me see if I can do it next week, Professor. Yeah, I mean, I'll be calling you, because this information is so good. And everybody, spread the word, because there are a lot of people out here that need direction and they don't know what to do. And these two books, between Finding a Career for Life and Entrepreneurial Success, can be just what they're looking for. Everybody, don't go away. Professor, thank you so much. I appreciate you. I'll be in touch. Okay, Professor, you still with us? Okay, Professor had to go. Everybody, I want to thank you so much for your time. Again, there are a lot of young people out here and a lot of older people out here that have yet to figure out what they want to do. You know, there are a lot of people out here that have talents, you know, but there's a way to go about becoming an entrepreneur. You don't just mosey into that. Professor Geiger has over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur, started over 11 businesses, okay, successfully. And he's written a book of 105 principles that are for not just business, but for life as well. So, for the small cost of the book, you can save somebody, possibly yourself or somebody you know, a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of headaches, and a lot of money. Okay? There's a way to go about starting a business, finding a business, growing your business. Okay? And if you're listening online, then you know about the archives, right? Scroll down the archives. You'll see other shows that I did with Professor Geiger in the archives, okay? Now, again, there's another book that he wrote called Finding a Career for Life. That book is perfect for a young person in high school, maybe a junior in high school, just trying to figure out, don't really know what they want to do. He gives the stats, okay? What jobs pay what? All right, so when a young person is making up their mind on what they want to do, at least they have the information to say, well, if I take this path, if I major in this, I can expect this amount of money. And when you think about it, the amount of money that we make or don't will determine oftentimes the quality of our life. It's going to determine where you live. It's going to determine what kind of car you drive. Okay, it might determine who you marry. Okay. That's how important that is, what you do once you, you know, have decided what path to take, what kind of income you make. That's going to determine so much in your life. So young people need to know, okay? So you might take somebody, I don't have anything against art, okay? But if some young person decides I want to go to school for art, fine. But just know that if you do, okay, this is what could possibly be your take home, okay? If you want to go to school for music, okay, if you wanted to get a degree in music, okay, nothing wrong with that. We all love music, so we love the people that make the music, right? But they need to know that if you get a degree in music, okay, that if you get a master's degree or a bachelor's degree or a doctorate degree, then this book is going to tell you what you can look to earn, okay? If you want to get a degree in social work, no problem. That's what you want to do. But just know in advance, before you spend 4 years in college, that this is the amount of money that you can expect to make as a social worker. Okay? All decisions, this is one of his principles in the book, all decisions should be data-driven, okay? See, we oftentimes get caught up in other stuff, right? You know, I do shows on spirituality. I have people come on talking about spirituality, right? But in business, all right, they speak a different language, okay? They speak a completely different language, all right? So, and you know what's interesting, and I'll share this because it's true, unfortunately, most of the people, the most spiritual people I know, not the most spiritual people, but a lot of the spiritual people that I know are broke, okay? I mean, a lot of God-fearing, God-loving, praying people who love God, but they don't have no money. Or they're living beneath what they could possibly believe, they're living beneath what they possibly, the standard of living that they could possibly be living at. Why? Because there are certain principles that are involved in business. They speak a different language. All right? You need to know the language. So, if you're interested in business and you're serious about business, you want to get these two books. Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. That's if you're already in business or you want to go into business. You need to know. All right? Or Finding a Career for Life. You need to know. So, the more you know, the less you don't know. And like somebody I know said, it's all right not to know, but it's not all right not to know once you know you don't know, and you don't seek the knowledge once you know you don't know. You know? My name is Juwanza, everybody. Thank you so much for your time. Listen, I invite everybody to scroll down the archives, and you're going to see some shows that are going to blow your mind, okay? Take a scroll down the archives. We've got shows on spirituality. We've got shows on health, okay? The name of the show is Juwanza for Life, also known as Health, Wealth, and Divine. We've got shows with people who've cured themselves of cancer. I mean, I got a special guest that comes on once a month, Coy Dunstan. He cured his mother of cancer in both breast, the liver, and the colon by changing her diet to a live it. Get it? Diet, live it. He changed her diet to a live it. The doctors had given her 6 weeks to live. He said, not my mother. He went out and found out what to do. He took her off meat, dairy, sugar, started fasting, started doing enemas, you know, threw away the microwave, all that stuff. Before it was over, he was back in the pulpit preaching, giving glory to God, okay? Dr. Lathan is a regular on the show. She had thyroid cancer. Doctor said they wanted to take the thyroid. She said, no, I think I'm going to try to change my lifestyle, become a vegetarian, a vegan. They said, that stuff don't work. Within a year, she was laughing at them. Okay, guess what? That stuff do work. All right? So scroll through the archives. We've got shows. We got shows on spirituality with Dr. Ronald Nefarman, Hexham Suheru Shekameb Nater. We've got shows with Dr. Orwa Hehimeduran Kamen. I mean, we've got shows on top of shows. And I guarantee you, if you listen and you're willing to grow, you will grow. And in the meantime, I just want to let you know how much I truly, truly appreciate you. Why do I say that? Because you could be doing anything, but you've chosen to take time out of your day to spend part of it with my person and my special guest today, Professor Joseph T. Geiger. So until the next time, everybody, thank you so much for your time. My name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more.